This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So we've written our stories to entertain. These notions of glory and bull market gain. The teleprompt flutters, the power surge brings. An easy speak message falls into routine.
Welcome back to the fall 2013 season of Radio EcoShock, broadcast on more than 70 college and community stations around the world. This is Alex Smith. Big news continues to pour in from around the world. It's dizzying, isn't it? We've got a lineup of guests, experts, and activists waiting to make sense of it all. As I left for a break in July, I issued a special podcast on the global heat wave. If you missed that, join the thousands who downloaded it from our website at ecoshock.org. At the time of broadcast, the heat wasn't quite complete around the Northern Hemisphere. The Russian Arctic still seemed coolish, and there was no word from China, although Japan was suffering through record heat. 1 week later, Siberia went into an extended heat alert with hundreds of fires. Southeast China went down to a killer heat wave, setting the highest coastal temperature records ever seen on the Pacific coast of Asia. Now that's saying something, over 100 years worth of records. So the circle went complete. I'm not sure if this is absolutely new, but in 25 years of reporting climate news, I can't remember a super hemispheric heat wave like this. We can't call it a global heat wave because, of course, it's winter in the southern hemisphere, but we can call it global warming, and 2013 is the year when we entered into that certain phase of climate change. I'll have lots more on all that later in the program as we do a climate rundown with Paul Beckwith, a postgrad climate scientist at the University of Ottawa. Paul is a favorite climate correspondent, really linked in to the latest in both extreme weather events and the latest science behind them, and of course we'll touch on what's happening in the Arctic as well. Meanwhile, we have the civil war in Syria, always threatening to grow larger. What a fascinating spiral of events coming out of that. We find Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia both promising and threatened Putin of Russia, a supporter of Syria's Assad. The Saudis reportedly offered to help fix the price of oil at a high level, which will affect our economy, of course, in return for Russian backing off from Syria. This is all in the mainstream press, including an illuminating piece by the top Telegraph financial correspondent Ambrose Evans Pritchard. There's more energy behind Syria than meets the eye. Everyone wants to control or stop a new natural gas pipeline across Syria. And did you know that Israel, along with Cyprus, has discovered a giant natural gas field in the Mediterranean? You remember Cyprus, the economy that crashed along with billions in offshore Russian accounts. Now Israel may have become a new energy power. There's a lot of debate within that country about how fast to drill and how to export this gas, but practically no talk about how even more fossil fuel emissions will drive Israel into heat exhaustion in the future. Not to mention rising seas damaging their ports, the cities, the coastline. Go, go, go. More carbon for the atmosphere. It's all the same here in British Columbia. An unpopular government was just re-elected on a big promise of a natural gas boom, mostly fracked gas, of course, to be liquefied and shipped by tanker to Asia. We may have to build a new hydro dam flooding another great mountain valley just to power a single LNG liquefaction facility. Our people voted for it. We love the high carbon future. It's all the same song in the U.S. and in Australia. More coal, more coal. This isn't going to end well. Cities based on all this killer energy aren't going to do well in the next decade or two. China must be the poster child for the future of an industrial economy on steroids, with the shift to impure factory foods, just for example. 114 million people now have diabetes. According to a report in Bloomberg, September 3rd, 40% of 18 to 29-year-olds are pre-diabetic in China, ready to develop the disease, which will eventually cripple and can cause loss of limbs. That's just one example. We're not talking about the poison river or the hundreds of tons of poisoned fish always reported every week. Another expert warns that in 25 years, 25% of the Chinese population will be at risk of developing dementia. Barry Greenberg, scientific advisor to the Alzheimer's Society of Canada, says the global economy is at risk just from the booming dementia rates alone around the world. We are heading into decades of trying to cope with a sick society, even as energy looks to become rare and very expensive. Many of us suspect there are dark and challenging times ahead. Fortunately, we are a very adaptive species. We have a lot of power inside of us. Many of the answers are out there if we are brave enough to take them. Some involve more love than technology. During the coming season of Radio EcoShock, I'll be searching out the scouts, those people already living in the outposts of a survivable human lifestyle. Whether you plan on moving out or drilling down good plant roots right where you are, stay tuned for more Radio EcoShock. Before we look at world-changing climate developments with Paul Beckwith, the continuing threat of the triple meltdown at Fukushima, Japan, has taken some new twists. Let's go to one of the best analysts anywhere out there to get the big picture for Japan and for the whole Northern Hemisphere, and especially the west coast of North America. No doubt you've heard more about the continuing nuclear disaster at Fukushima, Japan. Three nuclear reactors melted down in March 2011. A fourth had a fire and explosion in the fuel storage area. Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, has been struggling to contain radiation leaks ever since. Is Japan safe? Is the Pacific being polluted with radiation? What should we be looking forward to? I'm Alex Smith. Radio EcoShock welcomes back nuclear expert and whistleblower Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates. Arnie, thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, yeah, thanks for being interested in this topic for a long, long time. Wow. I appreciate coming back again.
It's going to take a long time. It's going to be as long as you and I are alive. We'll still be reporting about Fukushima. Well, I know you have some good news about reactors in the United States, but first let's look at the world's largest nuclear disaster, in my opinion. What are the media reporting about Fukushima Daiichi?
Well, after the accident, the mainstream media kind of let it go off the radar. And, of course, those of us who were aware of the sleeping dragon that it could become were constantly concerned. While Fukushima likely released a little less radiation into the air, it has released 10 times more radiation into water, into the ocean, than did Chernobyl. So we're dealing with an accident on par with Chernobyl. And while Chernobyl has almost stopped, Fukushima is still an ongoing disaster. So what happened that got the press's attention the last month was a large leak from one tank. And the radioactive concentration in the leak was extraordinarily high. Essentially, if you stood for 10 minutes next to the tank, the releases from the tank, you got a year's worth of radiation exposure. Another way of saying that is it was lethal in 4 hours. So this was really bad. Well, that's what ramped up the press interest. But in fact, that's just a drop in the bucket compared to the total amount of water that's been leaking into the Pacific for 2.5 years now. So the Pacific is contaminated, and that contamination is not abating. As a matter of fact, it's likely to get worse. We've got a wedge of radioactive material about halfway across the Pacific now, and it should hit the west coast of Canada and the west coast of the U.S. sometime in the next year. The radioactive concentration in that wedge of water is 10 times what it was from bomb testing. So we are seeing an appreciable increase in cesium concentrations and other isotopes in the Pacific. Now, the lesson here is the Pacific's a big place. And if we're contaminating the Pacific, can you imagine if this accident had happened on the Rhine or the Mississippi or the Great Lakes or the Danube? You would wipe out the water supply for a continent. And that's a risk that nuclear policymakers appear to be willing to take.
Does anyone really know, Arnie, where the leaked reactor cores are?
Well, I think they're still in the building, but the answer is no, no one knows. There's a thing called a containment building, and the nuclear reactors held together for about a day before they melted down, which means that the amount of heat that they had when they melted down was a little bit less. and there was water on the floor, which was able to cool them. But the net effect is that even if the nuclear reactors didn't melt into the ground, which we would call a China syndrome, it's just as bad anyway. Because what we've got now is a contaminated nuclear reactor core laying on the concrete, and that building, the containment building, is leaking like a sieve. So they're pumping water in, and it's laying right up against this nuclear reactor fuel, and it's leaking out all over the place into other buildings, directly into the groundwater. So to my way of thinking, a meltdown into the ground isn't necessary. We already have a situation that's almost as bad. We've got a meltdown on the concrete, water in contact with that concrete going everywhere. They need to keep adding water, too, because obviously this thing is hot. So in the process of cooling it, they create this huge amount of water, which then leaks into other buildings and directly into the ground and is contaminating the entire site.
So Fukushima is down near the ocean, but it's at the bottom of a big hill, and there's a whole flow of groundwater going through there. Now, the operator, TEPCO, proposed intercepting that groundwater above the plant to bypass the radioactive area and then pipe it somehow directly into the sea. Do you think that is viable? Could it help?
It was a good idea 2 years ago when I proposed it. I think now they've waited a little bit too long, and you know, the hill that the plant is built up against was actually a hill all the way to the water. So when the plant was built 40 years ago, they cut down the mountain and put these plants very close to water level, which, of course, made them susceptible to tsunamis. But what that's done is it's increased the hydraulic pressure of the water on the mountain behind it. So for 40 years, there's been 1,000 tons of water a day leaking onto the site. But because the plant was clean, it didn't matter. Well, now that 1,000 tons a day is leaking onto the site, but the plant is leaking into the ground. So the net effect here is that they're pushing water into the Pacific pretty much continuously, you know, day in, day out for 2+ years. Now, Woods Hole identified this a year ago when they said that, you know, the radioactivity in fish is not going down. And so Woods Hole was saying that that can only mean that the plant continues to leak. So nobody should be surprised here, you know, that scientists like me, the people at Woods Hole and others have been mentioning this groundwater problem for a year or two now. Yet, you know, Tokyo Electric seems to have magically just become aware of it. I think you're right, though, that the solution is not to prevent the water from going into the ocean. That seems to be everybody's focus, but to prevent the clean water from entering the plant. Now, what that means is they've got to get into the mountain and pull the water table down and pump that clean water out into the Pacific before it can enter the plant. That'll have the effect of dropping the water table on the site and gives them a chance anyway to prevent all this water from building up. Right now they got 380,000 tons of water in tanks on that site, and the tanks are not seismically qualified. So if they have an earthquake, it's likely that those tanks will fail and all that water will run right across the surface directly into the Pacific. So it's an ongoing, clear and present danger, and yet Tokyo Electric doesn't seem to want to make the problem go away quick enough.
This is Alex Smith. I'm talking with nuclear expert Arnie Gunderson from Fairwinds Associates. Let me just read you a quick quote from the Guardian newspaper, September 1st. It says, TEPCO admitted recently that only two workers had initially been assigned to check more than 1,000 storage tanks on the site. Neither of the workers carried dosimeters to measure their exposure to radiation. When I read things like that, Arnie, my feeling is that Tokyo Electric Power is just not up to the job of protecting us all. Do you think this accident requires an international response?
Yes, absolutely. Your reading and mine are right on the mark. You know, Tokyo Electric is, there's two problems. First, if they're an operating company, they claim to know how to operate nuclear reactors, although with Fukushima Daiichi's accident, that may be called into question too, but they're not an engineering company. And this is the biggest industrial accident in the history of the world. And we're asking a company with really no engineering expertise to try to solve a very complex problem. So that's problem number one. They are not up to the task. But the related problem is that the Japanese government isn't giving them enough money to solve these problems. They believe that Tokyo Electric should fund this cleanup itself. Well, this is a $100 billion cleanup on the site and a half a trillion dollars U.S. if you look at the state, the prefecture of Fukushima. And Tokyo Electric doesn't have the resources to do that. So they've been hamstrung by money. And my contacts at Tokyo Electric are telling me that part of the problem belongs with the Japanese government, who simply hasn't been funding this effort adequately. So when you hear two people walking around, you know, kicking the tires once a shift, that's an indication of, one, incompetence, but two, they don't have enough money.
In a previous Radio EcoShock interview, you said the Japanese should start unloading nuclear fuel bundles from Reactor 4 as a priority before that building collapses. Are they doing it?
Well, they're planning as of November to begin to do it. So they've made some progress on that. I think they're belittling the complexity of the task. Now, if you think of a nuclear fuel rack as a pack of cigarettes, and if you try to pull a cigarette straight up, it will come out. But these racks have been distorted. So now when they go in to try to pull the cigarette straight out, it's going to likely break and release radioactive cesium and other gases, xenon and krypton, into the air. So I suspect come November, December, January, we're going to hear that the building's been evacuated. They broke a fuel rod. The fuel rod is off-gassing. We have to wait a couple days, and then they'll go back in. So I suspect we'll have more airborne releases as they try to pull this fuel out. If they pull too hard, they'll snap the fuel. And I think the racks have been distorted. The fuel has been overheated because the pool boiled. And the net effect is that it's likely that some of the fuel will be stuck in there for a long, long time.
And I should point out to listeners that you were a fuel rack expert in the nuclear industry, so you know what you're talking about. Now, when the reactors blew up in March 2011, there was substantial radiation measured on the West Coast, right across the U.S. and even around the world. What have you heard about more recent pollution of the Pacific Ocean, and do you think it will reach North America in any amount that matters?
Yes, scientists had radiation detectors up in Seattle. Essentially, at the end of March all the way through April, we were able to determine that people in Seattle breathed in about 10 hot particles a day that wafted across the Pacific and would lodge in their lungs. We also had samples as far north as Vancouver and as far south as Portland, Oregon, that confirm that, you know, significant amounts of cesium, at least, and other isotopes were deposited on the soil after the accident. So now we've got a situation where we've got this wedge of water heading across the Pacific. And really, in the history of science, we've never seen anything like this. What I've been asking people on the West Coast to do is to contact their elected state representatives, or, you know, in your case, your province representatives, and get them to sample fish. You've got fish going out into this plume, eating other fish, and of course it goes up the food chain to the salmon and to the tuna and to the swordfish and things like that. I've also asked people on a national level to get a national fish monitoring program going. I think it's a disservice to the citizens of Canada and to the citizens of the U.S. that we're not getting this information. You know, the party line is officially, don't worry, we've tested it, the levels are low. Well, tell me what the number is, so I can watch the trends. So, you know, as a scientist, I want to know just how fast the cesium is working its way into the food chain. But the elected officials, both at the state and province level and at the national levels, are not providing us with that information. I don't even know if they're taking that information, but they certainly are not giving it out. And I think a transparent process will go a long way to alleviating fears about, you know, contamination in the food chain. Or, you know, we may show that we have a right to be afraid, in which case, you know, a transparent process would show that as well.
Now, before we move on to some better news about American nuclear power, is there anything else that you would like to add about Fukushima?
It ain't over. We're going to see problems coming up at Daiichi for years to come. I think the best solution is to basically entomb the plants within the next couple of years. And by that I mean after they get the groundwater down, so there's no more leakage into the groundwater, fill them with concrete and walk away for 100 years. These plants are so radioactive that they're highly irradiating the Japanese workers who are on those sites. And I think it does a disservice to, you know, thousands of men and some women who are being exposed to extraordinary high levels of radiation. You know, it ultimately affects the Japanese gene pool, and none of us want to see that happen. So what I hope happens is that Tokyo Electric decides to entomb the four reactors for, you know, upwards of 100 years and then go back in. 100 years from now, the radiation levels will be one-tenth what they are today. And, of course, that means a huge change for worker exposures. And the other issue, of course, is the liquid releases into the ocean. And I understand that just this week, right after the 1st of September, the Japanese will be releasing a plan on how to tackle that. And the good news is the government is stepping up and saying it has to spend some money. The bad news is it took the government 2 years to step up and say it has to spend some money.
Okay, now, Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates, you've been an expert witness on the Vermont Yankee reactor. You called for it to be shut down. Why, and what are the new developments there?
Well, Vermont Yankee's owner, a company called Entergy, 2 weeks ago announced that it was going to shut the plant down when it ran out of fuel in October of 2014. In other words, they had to buy new fuel in order to get another 18-month cycle out of it. And it was, rather than buy new fuel, they determined that they would just let the plant run down and cease generating about a year from now. It's a trend in the nuclear industry. In the U.S., we had 104 nuclear plants at the beginning of 2013, and now we're down to 99. We've lost Crystal River, and that was shut down by Duke because it had a major flaw and it was too expensive to fix. We've lost San Onofre 2 and 3. Those both had major flaws that were too expensive to fix. And I testified on all three of those. And we lost the Kewaunee plant out in Wisconsin because the utility determined it was just too expensive to run. And Vermont Yankee's kind of in between. One, it's expensive. It's a small plant with a large staff. But the other thing is they needed to make large cash improvements to the plant, on the order of $200 million. You know, why would you invest $200 million more in a plant that's already 43 years old when one breakdown of something else can shut you down forever? So their position was it makes better economic sense to run it down and put it in a decommissioning status. The big issue here in Vermont now is, what does that mean, decommissioning status? Entergy is saying that they want to keep the plant there for 60 years so that they can get enough money together to completely dismantle the plant. Of course, the state of Vermont doesn't want this carcass of a plant on the banks of the Connecticut River for any longer than 10 or 15 years. So the battle in the future here and at San Onofre and at Crystal River and at Kewaunee is, why in the world did the American Nuclear Regulatory Commission allow a 60-year cooling-off period so that utilities could get enough money to decommission these plants? What it does is it the generation that used the power, you know, people like me, will be long dead by the time the decommissioning occurs. So the costs are generationally transferred down to my grandkids. And I don't think that's fair. I think if you incur the, quote, benefit of nuclear power, you should also pay the costs of nuclear power and not generationally transfer those costs down, you know, to grandkids.
So, Arne, what's coming up on the nuclear calendar? Are there dates we should watch for or upcoming conferences of interest?
The big thing is there's a paper out by someone named Dr. Mark Cooper. And Dr. Cooper and I testify a lot, and he's a really brilliant guy. He works as an adjunct faculty at the Vermont Law School. And he published this paper that predicts that 30 nuclear plants in the U.S., so 30 out of 100, are on the verge of shutting down because they're no longer economically viable. So I think that we're not done with nuclear plant shutdowns in the future. We've got many old plants that are exactly like Fukushima Daiichi. We have 22 plants like Fukushima Daiichi in the United States, all of which need enormous improvements over the next couple of years. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is allowing these plants to not make any changes until 2019, in large part because they're pro-nuclear and they want to keep these plants running for as long as possible. But at the end of the day, they will become so expensive to fix that they'll be shut down, which is what Mark Cooper is saying. So I guess, you know, your listeners would should not be surprised if more nuclear plants are shut down in the future. The plants that occurred now were the initial earthquake, but we're going to have aftershocks for a year or two or three more, and as many as 30 U.S. nukes may be on the financial ropes.
Well, I'm hoping that they will close down before we have another Fukushima on American soil or Canadian soil or Europe or anywhere else in the world. But as you know, Arnie, I'm a nuclear activist. You are more of a nuclear expert, so we may disagree on that. But I'm severely worried about what's happening with nuclear power. And I also, I just want to bring up as we wrap up this one last issue that someone else has raised, Guy McPherson, for example, that if we had a breakdown of our electric grid, for example, from a solar storm, which is possible, it's a far out risk, but it's possible, then all of the nuclear plants around the world could melt down. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, it's called EMP, electromagnetic pulse. And if the sun sends an electromagnetic pulse out that's large enough, it could easily knock down the grid in, you know, Ontario or the east coast of the United States or something like that. The pulse shape is such that it would cause the nuclear plant to shut down, but it would not fry the electrical systems in the plant. It would destroy the transformers, which means that the plant couldn't ship power out, but it could likely keep itself cool off its diesels, assuming the diesels start. To me, the bigger worry is a nuclear weapon in space. I mean, if the Koreans really decide to do something, they could launch a warhead into space and fire it from orbit when they're over, you know, the east coast of the United States. That electric pulse from a nuclear weapon, not from a solar flare, but a nuclear weapon, is a different shape, and it fries electronics. It fries the integrated circuits in your computer. And if a country like Iran, you know, there's a bunch of them out there now who are nuclear-capable, Korea, chose to do it, there wouldn't be any damage on the ground, but the net effect would be that all of the computer networks, including the safety systems in a nuclear plant, could be jeopardized, and that could cause a meltdown. So one hopes that our opponents in this world are not that nefarious, but if you're concerned about a gross nuclear meltdown of many plants, likely not a solar flare, but likely you know, some sort of a warlike action from Iran or North Korea or someone like that.
Of course, whoever did it, we know that the nuclear radiation would not be limited right to wherever the accident happened. It would be horrible there, but it would still flow right around the northern hemisphere and get out into the oceans, as we've seen at Fukushima. So I hope we don't experience that, and I hope we make it with a clean, orderly shutdown of the plants that are the most dangerous, at least for the start. Arnie, I want to thank you so much for all you do. I hope you're going to join us again as this disaster continues. I want to tell listeners that they can find out a lot more about Fukushima and all the things nuclear at your website at fairwinds.com, and that's fair with the letter E after it, and then winds.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, Arnie.
All right. Thanks for having me. And again, thanks for caring about this.
Well, I do care about our world, and I know our listeners do, so that's why we do it. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. Climate change hit hard these past few months, even just within this past week. Extreme weather is striking all over the world.
But first, let's get to the extreme heat that's affecting many portions of the country.
Damage from powerful storms around the world. We're beginning with severe flooding.
There are countries that will be almost or totally submerged.
this nation's midsection, Oklahoma, Missouri, and parts of Arkansas as well. These areas have all been hit with tornadoes.
Climate change has certainly shown up here on planet Earth in a big way these past few months. Records are falling so fast with so many new changes, it's beyond our ability to track it all. But let's do a recap of some big climate news with one of our popular guests, Paul Beckwith. Paul is a PhD graduate student in the Laboratory for Paleoclimatology and Climatology, and he's a part-time professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada. He has a master's degree in physics as well. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Well, doing good, and I'm really glad that we got in touch because I've been following your Facebook page, and it's a very lively spot and a good place to keep up with what's going on. I wanted to start with the state of the Arctic sea ice. You made a prediction earlier this year that if we had the right cyclones at the right times, that maybe it could all break up this year. What is happening there?
Well, almost this year, the Arctic sea ice has been in a state that's been almost completely opposite to last year. Last year, it was very warm over the sea ice, and there were some massive cyclones, and the sea ice was kind of broken up into these very large chunks, and a lot of these large chunks were exported out through the Fram Strait and other parts of the Arctic. This year, it looked like we would have a very similar year initially, especially in March with the large cracking and breaking up of the ice, but it seems that what has happened this year is that the ice, rather than being broken up and exported in large chunks, it got completely shattered and fractured and broken up into very small chunks. And these small chunks, of course, will have a much larger surface area. And this larger surface area, since the melting is just the ice in contact with water, warm water or warm air, the melt rate of the individual ice pieces seemed to be much larger. And what that did is it kept the temperatures lower over the Arctic. Of course, we saw over Alaska and Siberia and other places, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, is warmer areas over there, although it was cooler over the Arctic sea ice. And I think the ice is actually creating that climate. So this would act as somewhat of a negative feedback to, on the short-term scale, to keep the ice. And the other thing is there were a number of these cyclones, but they weren't of the same magnitude as last year's. And instead of operating on pushing large chunks of ice out of the Arctic like they did last year, this year what they did is they caused a spreading out or a divergence of the ice, which was mostly first-year ice. So they kept the area of the sea ice larger. Of course, the thickness has still been dropping very quickly, so it'll be interesting to compare the thickness numbers with previous years because it was the Arctic ice volume that was falling exponentially.
Right. The other big story among many that you've been following are methane releases in the Arctic. What has happened there this year? What's going on with research? What are the levels of methane releases in the Arctic?
The methane, we've seen over the last number of years increases in methane emissions coming from the Arctic region. And these methane emissions are primarily from two sources. One is the on-land permafrost and tundra. When it melts or when it's subjected to wave action on the coast, we see large emissions of methane from that region. Also, the Arctic snow cover has been dropping rapidly, in fact, more rapidly than the sea ice, and most in the spring months. So sort of May, June months, the snow cover has been dropping extremely rapidly. So this exposes the underlying permafrost and tundra and thus can lead to warming and methane releases. Also, we've been seeing significant increases in methane coming up from areas that are uncovered when the sea ice is opened up and leaves, and it leaves behind the dark ocean water that will absorb more sunlight and warm up. And we have been seeing the warming up of the ocean completely down to the 50-meter deep continental shell. So that then will thaw sediments on the seafloor and cause increases. So areas where there was no sea ice from the melt, we would see increases in methane. And there are overflights done frequently now with methane instruments to measure sort of distributions of methane. And it's interesting because methane measurements, there's no reason why we can't get better and better measurements. Mass spectrometers were used a lot before, but you can have very low-cost spectrometers, laser spectrometers, which can measure methane concentrations to very high levels. And people are starting to do some of these near gas fields, near natural gas fields, near fracking sites, also from aircraft, various places. And there are very sensitive sensors on satellites, the atmospheric infrared satellites, or short form is AIRS satellites. There's lots of good methane data. You can go to methanetracker.org, I believe it is, or .com, and get lots of slices through the atmosphere of methane. The thing about methane in the Arctic, too, is the global warming potential of methane, the number that people are familiar with is 22 or 25 times relative to CO2, but that's on a 100-year time scale. On a decade or two-year time scale, it's more like 70. And if you look at it on a few-year time scale, then it's more like 150 times. So if you have a methane source in the Arctic, methane's coming up. It will stay above that region for a while before it spreads around the planet, and it can cause significant localized warming of regions where it's coming up from.
Well, Dr. Shakova of the University of Alaska and others with her in Russia have been investigating this, and they have said that it's possible we could get a huge burst of methane if the landscape under the sea shifts around a little bit. You get some landslides or something. And then Peter Wadhams, who you know very well, has brought out a study with others saying if that happened, it could cost $60 trillion. Talk to us about that, would you?
Yes, the basic thing that methane has the power to basically change the background climate of our planet. So changing the background climate, and it can do this over a very short time scale, a time scale of decades or a decade or two or even shorter. We know this because we have seen in the paleo records of the past periods of time where the Earth's temperature shifted very rapidly in regions, and this has been attributed to methane in at least a few different cases, if not many cases. And the reason is because in the Arctic, if you have the jet stream circling the planet and kind of keeping the colder air north of the jet streams, warmer air south, and so the methane coming up in the Arctic has the potential to stay there for longer than it would at other locations of the planet. You know, this also ties into the jet stream. When you get jet streams that are very distorted because of the reduced temperature gradient between the pole Arctic and the equator, then since weather patterns follow these jet streams, you can get very, and they're slowing, you can get very persistent storm activity or very persistent blocking activity, which, for example, leads to very high temperatures in Alaska for weeks on end, as we saw earlier in the summer, and then very, very warm temperatures over Siberia and other regions, whereas some regions further south or further from the pole get very warm temperatures. For example, the jet streams in the southern hemisphere, not too many people talk about them, but they are also behaving in an unusual fashion, and we saw them extend up over large parts of South America, leading to record cold temperatures in South America, and they had record levels of snowfall in the Atacama Desert, which is very, very unusual. I mean, this is a place where there's weather stations there that have not registered any precipitation for 400 years. Depending on who you believe, the rainfall there on an annual basis is less than 10 millimeters, according to some. In some regions higher up, it's like 0.1 millimeter. And suddenly when we get 20 or 30 centimeters of snow in these regions, it's a very, very unusual event. Although it did happen just a few years ago. So we're seeing two extremely low likelihood events happening back to back down there. And if you happen to be north of those jet streams in the southern hemisphere, like in New Zealand, you get record high temperatures, the highest temperatures they've seen. They've seen temperatures higher by, you know, I think mean annual temperatures are higher by several degrees in New Zealand, for example. Whereas, as I mentioned, in South America, average mean temperatures have been almost, you know, 5 to 9 degrees colder. Just depends on where you are relative to these curved jet streams.
Yes, they're huge bends. I mean, they're saying up to 250,000 alpacas died in Bolivia and Peru, that the crops that are essential to feed people there have been severely damaged by this finger of cold coming up from Antarctica. And meanwhile, as you say, in New Zealand, they had the warmest winter they've ever recorded. So it may help their agriculture a little bit. It depends on where you're standing. Back to Siberia just for a minute. Extreme floods in eastern Russia along the Amur River in particular, right on the border with China. It's part of Siberia, though. Things that they've never seen before. Putin went over there and tried to get people working on it even more. It hasn't gone down yet, may not for months. Thousands flooded out. It's a big event.
Yeah, what is happening is the climate has warmed, and because it's warm, there's more evaporation. So for every degree of warming over a particular region, there's about 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere. And the reason that's important is because that water vapor, as it climbs higher into the atmosphere, it condenses, forming the clouds and, leads to rainfall. So there's more water vapor in the air, there's more condensation, more rainfall, and that the energy, tremendous amounts of energy are required to evaporate water, but also that energy is released when that water condenses into clouds. So these storms are more, they have more energy, they're more extreme, they're more violent storms, and they're basically trending along the jet stream patterns, jet stream regions. So if the jet streams are operating, are moving more slowly west to east, then those storms are more persistent. And we're seeing these large flooding events, like the jet stream kind of stalled and twisted, it was raising water vapor over the Rockies in the summer a few months ago. So this caused extreme rainfall on the slopes near Banff, and of course that water plug in all the rivers moved right through into Calgary, flooding out Calgary, as we all remember. And the costs of that event are $3 to $5 billion, they're saying. I think it's well over three at the latest count. And then a week or two or a few weeks after that happened, a similar but different event happened in Toronto. And in Toronto's case, you had warm, moist air coming off of Lake Ontario being swept up with a very fast jet stream streak. And it pulled it all up through, and it was deposited over large areas of Toronto with the maximum rainfalls in the western parts. 3 inches of rain, 75 millimeters in between 5 and 6 p.m., I believe, on the day of the storm. And then over the rest of the storm, there were another 2 inches or 50 millimeters of rain. So this was 3 to 5 to higher. There was some areas that were even higher rainfall, you know, on a city in one evening. And, of course, the water has to go somewhere because the ground was mostly saturated from previous rainfall. It was mostly just runoff and ended up in underpasses and did major damage. And this is, I think, the number on that price-wise was about $800 million or something, probably still counting. So it's just, I think it's important for all cities to sort of look at, assume such a rainfall event, 5 inches is a night, in a night, 6 inches, determine the low areas of the city, determine where the water's going, what effect it's going to have, how long it will take to drain off, and so on. It's only prudent that cities do this, because many, many cities around the planet are experiencing this. In Manila, we expect lots of rain there. We hear of them being flooded out frequently. They have monsoons parts of the year. But they received about 2 feet of rain in 24 hours. And even in a very extreme monsoon, they might get about a foot of rain in 3 or 4 days or a week or something, not 2 feet in one 24-hour period. So, of course, that flooded out three-quarters of the country. But, news is weighed very differently by people, by decision-makers, depending on where it comes from. you know, stuff that happens locally to where you live, if you're a decision maker, weighs on your policies much, much more than, you know, on some other part of the, you know, some distant part of the world, or even in third world countries, you know, less developed countries. So these events are happening, you know, in any given week you can find events like this happening around the world. It's just the ones that have more significance on us and on our, you know, what we remember about the climate and, you know, further changes in policy and so on, politicians' views. They're not sticking all these events. They don't see the big picture of how the climate is changing.
Sure. I mean, who cares about Siberia? We hardly even heard about these Russian floods. It wasn't on the mainstream media. And I totally agree with you about every country is sort of focused on themselves, and then they don't hear about the world picture. But getting to North America, I think what a lot of people in the United States are thinking about is that super fire in Yosemite area of California. Again, it was just a record setter and an amazing fire. Do you think those conditions could be climate related?
I don't think there's any question that what climate does, it sets up persistent weather patterns in the case of fires of, you know, drought, and it dries out the soil. I mean, you know, if you're in a drought that's not lasting too long, then the soil has retained a lot of moisture, and then that can keep the vegetation going. But then as the soil moisture vanishes in a persistent drought or more severe drought, first of all, it weakens the trees, and then they get attacked more by things like pine beetle and different or emerald ash borer. So they become very weakened in the first place. And then when a fire comes, it will burn that much hotter and that much intensely and carry right down into the soils, burning parts of the organic matter in the soils. And then it will create these very strong updrafts, creating this phenomenon which is sometimes seen called firenados. It's almost like a tornado with, you know, fire flames spiraling up very high. And, of course, things like that can spread the fire. And then so they're burning much hotter, and they're burning much larger areas. Some friends of mine, I used to live in the Thousand Oaks area of California, and I think it was back in March, there were some very unusual, very large fires that occurred in that region, and they basically burned from the area of Thousand Oaks and they made it almost down to the ocean about 20 miles away, just going through the valleys and so on. So I think with fires, I think it's very important that we kind of change our strategies with fires, and because it seems like me that these fires, they start and then there's resources put to try to contain them, but and then later on they get enormous and then we throw enormous resources at them. Well, it just makes sense that when these fires start, we throw enormous resources on them and put them out before they can develop into these super fire type events.
More adaptation. And I'll just mention in passing that the USDA has talked about a flash drought of unseasonably hot and dry weather in the Midwest that affects corn and wheat prices in Kansas right through to Iowa. We don't have really time to talk about that right now. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Paul Beckwith. He's studying and teaching climate science at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Well, Paul, I think we should get a little bit more back to the science here, and in particular about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Now, they're operating on a six-year cycle. Look at all the things we've just been talking about, and we barely scratched the surface of what's going on the Earth right now. How's the IPCC system working out for us?
Well, I think the next massive report from the IPCC, which is following that six-year cycle, is due out, I believe it's this month. So I think that this report should be sort of the basis moving forward, and I think what we need to do is have a report generated. Like, first of all, you know, who generates these reports? I mean, it's basically volunteer scientists who are specialized in their particular area, and they acquire papers and get people, you know, authors to contribute to different sections that they're responsible for in the report. So there's a lot of work involved for some of these people, and they obviously they can't be doing this all the time. So I think once you have the you know, this report come out, the basis report, I think it should be the last sort of 6-year report. I think moving forward, I think whenever a significant paper comes out, that adds a lot of new information that is very important to humanity on climate change, that there should be an update going into the IPCC webpage and document. There has to be a way to make it more relevant to people. I mean, it's very important for us to be tracking, you know, in one place what is going on. So but I think whether it go down to like 6 months updates or yearly updates, but these updates can be short. They could just be, we were wrong with this projection. The much more accurate projection is such and such. You know, because one of the areas that the IPCC is still not really covering is methane emissions from the Arctic. I mean, we'll see when the report comes out, but the models that are coming out in this report are assuming that the methane is mostly staying in place. And if we're not seeing that happen, then the report is just missing this. And it's the report can actually do more harm than good in that case if it's not reflecting the reality of a rapidly changing climate system. Just the other day, I saw somebody suggesting that perhaps the IPCC reports on the different sections could be sort of like a wiki, which is a sequential blog, basically, so that if there's new research and new things updated, then they could be quickly given the okay they could be sent out to like some of the key scientists in that area who can then look at it and say, yes, we'll go with this. And then it could be on an updated sort of wiki or blog or something like the idea of a report every 6 years, with the speed of information travel through social networks and through, you know, online journals and stuff, it just makes no sense to maintain the existing IPCC model of once every 6 years.
No, I want to see big buildings appear in every continent full of scientists that are working full-time on integrating this information in real time and bringing it out to the public so that we can do something or adapt and try and reduce our emissions. Well, look, you are kind of breaking the model of what a scientist has been. You know, it used to be that a scientist was expected to keep quiet until they publish a paper, so it might be years of work, and then suddenly they say something. Versus Stephen Schneider's, the late Stephen Schneider's wonderful book, Science as a Contact Sport, where he said, that's not going to work. Things are moving too fast. Climate scientists need to be active communicators, and you're certainly doing that. How do you feel about this change of role?
The old model is being quiet and just publishing. That's the norm, basically, that old model. And it's the norm in many different fields of science. And it's important to have some people that are still following that model. But in areas like climate science where, you know, you study it, I can just about guarantee that anybody studying it and getting to know sort of the nuances and the ins and outs, and not just studying a very specialized area like, say, glaciology or permafrost physics, you know, science, or, you know, methane emissions or atmospheric science. I mean, it's a multidisciplinary field that is very important to have people that are looking at the overall big picture, that are basically reviewing what other people have done in all these different areas and trying to fit it together as pieces, taking these areas as pieces of a big jigsaw puzzle, trying to fit the puzzle together to enable one to see, you know, where we're going, what's happening with the climate, what's going to happen next. I mean, there's still going to be lots of surprises. For example, last year we had record temperatures in the Arctic and record loss of ice. This year we had record temperatures on the fringes, on the land around the Arctic, but we had very cold temperatures over the Arctic, and, you know, a huge whiplash or seesaw from one to the other. And we're seeing this whiplash and seesaw in many areas. For example, you know, if you live near the Mississippi, we had record low levels in January. In December of last year, the Army Corps of Engineers was hydraulically blasting rock on the bottom of the Mississippi to deepen the channel so that the barge traffic, which is vital to the economic well-being of the U.S., so that could be maintained. And then about 3 or 4 or 5 months later, we were back to record levels of water in those areas, you know, record and flooding. And the year before the drought and the drying up had occurred, we also had record levels, record flooding. So there's lots of things that are going to happen, which throw us for loops. But that doesn't mean that it's still very important to try to understand the system and also to be very flexible. So if your views and ideas on how the system is behaving are not working out or completely wrong or reversed, you try to incorporate, rather than that stopping you from trying to figure out what the system is doing, it's important to incorporate that new knowledge and try to find out what you missed, where you're going. Because the models kind of do that. They do that on an analytical calculation type basis. But there's still lots of things that the human brain can do in terms of pattern recognition to understand the climate system. And then those things can be verified by observations and by models further down the line.
Well, I think we can say we've destabilized the climate. So it's the change part of climate change that we better get used to. From the Laboratory for Paleoclimatology and Climatology at the University of Ottawa, Canada, we have been speaking with Paul Beckwith. Paul, I've followed you very actively on Facebook, as I said. Is that the best way for people to keep up with you?
I think, yes, probably my Facebook page, which is just Paul Beckwith, B-E-C-K-W-I-T-H. And also my Twitter feeds, which is P-A-U-L, Paul H. Beckwith, B-E-C-K-W-I-T-H, no spaces. I also blog for various blogs like Arctic News and the Sierra Club Canada and the Canadian Daily and many other ones also.
Good enough. Find this program as a free download and more links to the stories we've been discussing with Paul in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
My thanks to all the people who donated or signed up for our monthly Radio EcoShock membership at the website ecoshock.org. I have not had time to thank you all personally. This past month has been almost constant turmoil for me. Aside from vehicle breakdowns, we are renovating and preparing to move out of Vancouver to a rural village. More about that in coming shows. 1 week ago, the main hard drive on my production computer died. I lost everything. I'm working on the fly from an ancient box out of our basement, coping as I can. Without the help of Radio EcoShock listeners, I'm not sure we could afford the repairs. The refurbished audio computer will be back online in a week or so. My next show may be right out of the moving van. These changes in my personal life seem to echo the big changes happening on the planet and in our society. I tell myself, we are all going to need fallback plans, preparation, and an ability to adapt or move, perhaps on short notice. It could be fires, it could be floods, it could be storms, it could be economic problems, we don't know yet. The days of growing up in a stable society, where you can plan on one education for one lifetime job, it's pretty well done for most of us. Already the average person may have two or three careers. As the economic engine winds down, and it will, along with the environment, and it is, we'll have to expand our ideas about who we are and what a good life is. Our parents and grandparents went through two world wars and a Great Depression. If my reading of the climate, energy, and economic scene is correct, they had it easy. Expect to enjoy life, sure, but expect to struggle as well. I'm hoping to help you do both in coming shows, while being brutally honest about my own attempts, failures, shortcomings, and small wins if they come. I am Alex Smith. Thank you so much for joining me in this new season of Radio EcoShock. Our music clips this week came from the marvelous Suvarna, plus Till the Day is Done by R.E.M.
What have I done? What have I done? So tie your babies and your guns. Forgive us our trespasses, Father and Son. Providence blinked, facing the sun. And where are we left to carry on? Until the day is done. Until the day is done.
until the day ends.